Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am fantastic. This is Toxic and Problematic, a podcast that we do once a week, usually.
Yeah.
Brought to you by our friends over at Mitra 9.
Mitra-9.com.
Yeah, Mitra-9.com. Go get yourself some Go Packs.
I got some in my pocket for this weekend.
He's got his Go Packs ready to go. Has one every day.
One for each day. I have one every morning. Makes me feel better.
When
gives
you
me a little bit of energy. I don't know if I got a back pain or something, it goes away.
My buddy,
I like it.
Always drinks one before he works out. But whatever the case may be, go there and use the promo code PROBLEMATIC so that you get yourself a discount and so that we get the recognition we desperately want. We're always looking for validation, and that's one form of it. We have a guest today. I love the idea of her, by the way.
I'm doing Pelosi over all of them, though, by the way.
I really hope that she doesn't download this podcast. Not Pelosi. I know she doesn't know how to use a phone. But I really hope that Nurse Julie doesn't download this podcast and like, oh, I should see how this went, and then hear us talking about Boebert and AOC. But we have a guest. Thanks to our old producer in there, Snowcone, he got us a bona fide guest, Nurse Julie. I mean, she's like, she's internet famous now. She's got a book coming out next month, and she's on, I've heard her on a lot of other podcasts. I'm sure we're about to hear her on a lot more and probably start seeing her on TV. But she's a hospice nurse, and she has really created a big following on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, talking about death and trying to remove some of the stigmas around death. And she thinks that if we, you know, if I'm understanding the synopsis from her book here, because I haven't read it yet, but if I'm understanding this correctly, she's saying if we would talk about death more and if we knew more about death, we might be less afraid of death and that we shouldn't be afraid of death. Once you start to experience it and have it around you and talk about it openly, death becomes less taboo, and she thinks it would be a big benefit to all of us because there's one thing we all have in common, and that is that we ain't getting out of here alive. So I think it's an interesting concept, and the thing is, if you said, hey, this hospice nurse is going to go on social media and start talking about trying to remove the stigmas surrounding death, do you think she'll get a large following? I would go, eh, you know, you might get a niche thing.
Right.
You might, but I don't know. People are scared to talk about death. But then if you show me her video, any of her videos, I can see immediately, oh, this is why she's popular. She's great, and she's more than just a little bit popular. I think at this point she has well over a million subscribers. So Nurse, I think we just call her Nurse Julie, right? Julie McFadden.
Yep, that's
and
it.
We just call her Nurse Julie, and we are talking to her now. Hello, Nurse Julie. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, good morning. Yeah, whatever time people are listening to this. It's here, it's getting close to noon, but it's our morning. We don't usually get up this early. So we came in just to talk to you. How are you?
Oh my gosh, thank you. I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. So for people who don't know Nurse Julie, you have become quite the celebrity on social media. on TikTok. I mean, I would say, you know, you're doing well when you get to the point where I didn't have to follow you and I can talk to other people who weren't already following you and they say, I saw her because it showed up in a feed somewhere. Some people, you know, maybe Instagram, I tend to use Instagram more, but a lot of people that I've talked to are familiar, like, oh yeah, I saw her and now I follow her. How many followers do you have on social media now?
I mean, around 3 million. Which is insane to even say.
Legit.
I can't believe it myself.
When you started talking about death and these types of things, did you think people are going to be interested in this, or did you just do it for a small amount of people who, you know,
educational,
needed coping,
yeah,
you know, like, oh, man, this sucks.
Right.
And if they're, you know, I would think that's probably when you start looking into this type of stuff, is you're like, either you're dying or someone you love is dying.
Right. I mean, it truly did come to a surprise for me. I had about 5 videos in mind, just 5 things, like the most important things that I thought people should know. And in my everyday, like, real life, people didn't want to talk to me about this stuff. People, you know, people at dinner parties were like, a hospice nurse, yikes. You know, like, they weren't asking me questions. So I was really surprised when on I had a different response on the internet. I mean, it took like 4 days in, like 4 days. I didn't really have to try. It just took off on its own.
Well, I have to admit, I'm one of those people, like a hospice nurse, palliative care. There's a facility that was built not that long ago, close to here, that I drive by often. And when they built it, I was like, oh, that's a nice looking building. What is that? And someone told me, oh, well, that's a hospice care facility. And I mean, just being honest, I kind of shuddered like, oh, people are dying there. And I don't know if that's a cultural thing, if Americans are especially bad about death and talking about death, or if this is a universal thing. But it is something that people just don't want to talk about and don't want to think about. We know we're going to die, but we kind of tell ourselves, but I'm not gonna, right?
At least not today.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I do think it's a cultural thing. It does seem to be worldwide, but I've most experienced, obviously, in America. And definitely here, I think with Western medicine, modern medicine, preserving life at all costs, which is a whole other soapbox I can get into. But it's very taboo. And it's very misunderstood, too. It's very misunderstood. So hence why I'm here,
yeah,
baby.
Well, and I've heard people say, if we talk about it more, then we could maybe not be so scared of death. It would be healthy for us to talk about. I've heard that my whole life, but we never talk about it. And now you are talking about it. So I feel like you're the first person I've seen who's actually saying, okay, well, we keep saying we should talk about it more. We should remove some of the stigma. And I'm going to be the one to do it. And so you've done it. You have 3 million followers.
And you
now
say that it's very misunderstood. What's misunderstood about death?
Everything. First off, that it's painful. People think, now, granted, I'm talking generally here. So I'm talking like a natural death, meaning you're dying from something, right? A disease, but you're going to let it naturally happen because there's nothing more you can do. That process of death is not painful. Now, diseases can cause pain and symptoms, things like that. But like the actual dying process where you're allowing the natural process to happen, our body has built-in mechanisms to help us do it. So biologically, we're built to do it. So one of the big misconceptions is like dying itself is painful, which is not true.
Well, but I guess
things you die from can be, but not.
Well, what's the difference?
Right, because that's the fear.
Because I mean, like, yeah, if you're saying, well, dying itself isn't painful, but the things that kill you are, it's like, well, okay. The car crash itself doesn't hurt, but going through the windshield fucking does. So, I mean, what's the difference to me?
Oh my God, I love you guys. I love that you just swore. Are we allowed to swear on the radio?
You can swear as much as you want.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. So, I also get that backlash a lot, too. So I'm not talking about car crashes, first off.
Well, I was just using it as an example. But if cancer hurts, you know what I mean?
So what I mean is, say you're dying from pancreatic cancer.
Oh, my God. Why'd you have to do that one? Oh, pancreatic cancer.
Am I allowed to say this?
We don't say those words together in this studio ever.
Oh, man.
Scared
and you are, I will tell you, you are talking to the biggest 2 hypochondriacs in the world.
Oh, no, you guys.
Yeah, okay, so like I can, I have given myself, honest to God, I thought I had ALS.
And I watched him deteriorate
and
over the course of 7 months.
And I actually had a nervous breakdown. I went to several doctors who told me you don't have it, and I thought they were quacks. I was out. I was trying to golf, like just go do regular stuff because I knew I was dying. And I happened to have a good friend of mine. His cousin was a doctor. And he said, what do you think you have? And I said, ALS. And he's like, oh, shit. He's like, you should come in and talk to me. So I went in and talked to him, and he ended up, he ended up saying, well, and long story short, he ended up saying, you have, there's no test for it. I don't know if you have it. I don't know if I have it. So let's just have a little bit of faith here real quick, and let's get you on some anti-anxiety medicine, some Lexapro, see what happens, give you some Klonopin, and then Come back in a couple of months. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, we'll take you down. We can do MRIs and those types of things and just figure out what's going on. And I came back and he said, "Do you still feel bad?" And I said, "I do." And he said, "What about when you take the Klonopin?" And I said, "Actually, to be honest, I feel better." And he said, "Okay, well, they don't treat ALS with Klonopin, so let's figure out what the fuck's going on."
Yeah.
And I took Lexapro for about a year, and I'm fine. It hasn't happened since then. But I can't look at WebMD or any of that stuff, or I'll start to freak out.
No. Yeah, and for me, and I'll make it very short. This will be great for us,
because you're right. Like, pancreatic cancer. I'm like, ah!
I have my work cut out for me, and I cannot wait.
Okay. I trace mine back to fifth grade, go to the doctor, and I had a doctor tell my parents, and I overheard this, that he said I had cancer. And my parents were trying to hide this from me. They're crying. They're talking on the phone about it. They thought that I had cancer. So for 2 weeks in the fifth grade, I thought I had cancer. So from that moment on, I associated going to the doctor with bad news. They're the ones who can tell you you're going to die. And to me, the actual act of dying itself, like what you're describing, as I am shutting down, that's not so much what scares me. What scares me is the diagnosis and then, okay, the timestamp. You've got X number of months you can expect to live or whatever. I don't know how I will handle that.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
This is good.
That's a lot to unpack.
I'm telling you.
All right.
I'm telling you this is all good. So first up, let me, just because I know listeners are probably really want this answered, because many people do, about the how can you say dying is not painful, but the symptoms are. Just really quick. So what I mean by that is we can manage, on hospice, we're experts at managing symptoms for the most part. We should be anyway. Not everyone's going to have a good experience, but we work our butts off to make sure that we control symptoms like pain or shortness of breath, which are probably like the two biggest symptoms we see on hospice, right? So we can manage those of the disease you're dying from. The other parts, right, of which, if people don't know, main things you see at the end of life are sleeping a lot and not eating and drinking, and maybe confusion. Sleeping a lot, not eating and drinking, some disorientation. Those things itself are not painful because we have built-in mechanisms in our body that shut off things in our brain that say you're hungry, you're thirsty. So people who are not eating and drinking are not laying there being like, I'm so hungry and thirsty, I wish I could do it, but I can't. That's not happening. And our calcium levels rise, so we sleep all the time. We can go into ketosis, which releases endorphins, which makes us feel euphoric, and dulls pain. So that's a little example of stuff that happens biologically in our bodies to help us not suffer when we're dying.
I have to tell you this. I hate to do it, but I have to tell you this. When my dad was dying, we knew that he was dying for, you know, a couple of weeks. He spent the last couple of weeks of his life in the hospital as he, you know, deteriorated rather quickly. And towards the end there, one of the things that he kept asking me for was water. Give me something to drink. And they would only let me give him a little sponge, like a wet sponge. He was getting so angry about that, and he was so thirsty, but they wouldn't let him have any water. And I'm thinking, he's dying, just let him have water. But also, he was in a hospital, and I don't know, you know, I don't really know the difference between being in the ICU, palliative care, hospice. That's something that I don't fully understand.
We would not. So I understand. So in hospitals, sometimes they'll have certain protocols. I don't know exactly what was going on with your dad, but that I also hear this. This is what I'm saying. This is good. We need to talk about this stuff. So in hospitals, a lot of times we don't do end of life very well there. I'm generally speaking now, because that's not true everywhere. But so a few things could have been happening. One, he could have lost his ability to swallow. Do you know if that was going on?
No, they were worried about his intestines, his digestive tract, and it not being, you know, he'd had surgery recently to try, and so they were worried about him taking on too much liquids and stressing out his insides.
Okay, so that was the problem there. So it's because he wasn't on hospice. So this is why people need to, not be afraid about hospice, because in the hospital, because we're not really, we're trying to preserve life at all costs, right? We're trying to make sure someone doesn't die. So because of that, and I don't know what was going on there, but if he was truly end of life, and you guys, did you guys know that? Like, did everyone know he was in the hospital? Like, he was there?
Yeah, eventually there was no going back. We knew that he wasn't going to make it. But I don't know. You know, the doctors take a lot longer than they should to tell you the truth about that.
They really should,
but after he had his last emergency surgery or whatever, it was clear that things weren't going well. But if I had told him while he was still conscious, if I had told him, hey, you know, they're saying you're not going to make it, we're going to move you to hospice, I think he would have not liked that, you know? And just knowing him, he's a lot like me, or he was a lot like me in the sense that I've always said, if I'm dying on the battlefield, I want the medic to tell me that it's not that bad. It just looks bad. You're fine, even if he knows I'm dying. And that's how my dad was.
Yeah, yeah. And that's okay. You guys, it can, so one, that's okay. We're not going to change them. We're not going to change someone in the moment they're in. We're not going to be like, now you're not going to care that you're dying, you know, just mm-hmm. because we say it's okay. And I do hope that through this education, eventually, generationally, we can become a little more, we can just become a little less scared about what's going on and have a little more ability to feel uncomfortable about the things we're talking about and realize that it's really normal to feel uncomfortable and afraid and that's okay too. And from what I found is, people who are like, you know how you guys were just talking about, like, I'm a hypochondriac, I fear this.
Yeah.
I always think I'm going to die. So that's like one thing. If it's actually really severe, and like you said before, like, one of you said, like, I basically had like a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a little different in the sense of like, I wouldn't necessarily push you to constantly talk about death if you have if you're a true hypochondriac and have like severe death anxiety. That's like a whole nother issue where like that has to do with anxiety and control and a bunch of other things. So it's not like, I would continue to push you to keep doing that. But generally speaking, it's okay if you feel afraid of death. That's super normal. And just because you feel afraid and it's really uncomfortable doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it. And from what I've seen, literally hundreds of times, from dying people and their families, is that the people who are willing to say the hard things, say things like, I'm afraid to die, I don't want to die, I'm angry about dying, they don't have to be positive. They don't have to be like, I've accepted this and I'm okay. They can say all the things. They seem to live better while they're still alive and die better, meaning more peaceful.
Let me ask you this. Do you think they say that? When you said that, I think I would say, I'm okay, it's going to be okay. And I'm curious if that comes from you want to protect the people who are still living. So even though I'm scared and I'm freaking out, I want to tell my kids and my mom or whatever, hey, I got this. Don't worry about it. I'm not scared at all. And then they all go home and I'm in hospice like, fuck me. Why me? Right?
You're right. You know, I think it depends on the family. So I think why not all of us just be honest? Because I feel like you being honest with them can help them be honest with how they really feel and you could have a real moment.
Right.
So that's one. But two, people die how they live. Like, we're not going to change family dynamics in one instance, right? So if that is how it's going to go and you feel better doing that and you think that's better for your family, then I would suggest people to talk to someone then. Because hospice is a full team. It's not just a nurse and a doctor. There's a social worker. There's a chaplain. There's people who are trained, and every day of their life, they talk to people about dying. So at least talk to someone. If you're not going to talk to your family, then talk to someone so you can get it out. But I think it's okay to talk to your family. But again, like, I realize family dynamics aren't going to change in an instant just because someone's dying, you know? So you could always get help with that too. You could have a family meeting. I always suggest family meetings, which happens on hospice all the time, and people don't utilize it enough, where you get the whole team together, professionals who are used to dealing with this, to kind of help you navigate the conversation of what's going on. And it's only because, this is why I push this so hard, people don't want to suffer. People always say, I just don't want to suffer at the end of life. Then what I've seen is talking about it helps you not suffer, even though people think the opposite. It's like, if I just avoid it, if I just don't talk about it, if I just put my head in the sand, that's going to make it better. And that, I mean, 10 out of 10, it usually makes it worse.
Well, it does seem like people used to talk about it more in the past when you know... see books from 100 or more years ago, and just the way that people used to talk about death. And I don't remember who told me this, but I remember someone saying it just made sense that they were surrounded by death. You know, death was so much more common.
Yeah.
And so because it was so much more common, and they were likely to encounter, you know, even bodies potentially in public spaces. Someone might get shot, killed, or whatever. they saw death around them. They had diseases and children dying. Because they were around death so much, they had a much easier time discussing death and thinking about death than we do. Where we say, don't talk about it, don't think about it. And if that person's dying, put them in that new building over there that, you know, I hope to never see the inside of.
Yeah. I feel like we've kind of like institutionalized death, which is something that is going to happen to all of us. And we didn't go to the hospital to die. First off, most people died in their homes just as early as late 1800s. People were always dying in their homes. You didn't go to a hospital to die.
Right.
You always were dying at home. So, and your family was always the ones watching you and caring for you to do that. So people knew what death looked like. They knew how to care for people. It wasn't this like emergency. And I think, I mean, that just changed just because of modern medicine, which is good and bad. I mean, it is good. Modern medicine has helped us live much longer and had done amazing things, but it's also no one knows what death looks like. They think it's like the movies where someone gives like a big long monologue and then closes their eyes and dies.
Right.
And that's just not how it goes.
No.
Ever.
Well,
almost ever.
Can I just tell you, you know, I did mention that my father passed away, so I did watch that, which was, it sounds callous, but educational in a lot of ways. Certainly a life experience. But my thought about death is, if I don't get hit by a bus or fall off a ladder, hit my head or just have a heart attack and drop dead, if I end up sick in the hospital, my thought is that, okay, if that happens to you and it's terminal, they're going to give me all the best opiates they can, pump me full of them to relax me and to help the pain and to ease me, you know, out of this life. That's basically all I know, and that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Banking on?
Kind of banking on that. Like, I hope I don't get there that day, and the day I'm there, like, oh, we're out of drugs today. But that's my thought. It's like, I think they hook you up to a big bag of brown liquid that I assume has heroin in it, and they just pump you full of it as you go. That's really what I think happens.
It is medical heroin. I mean, it is the same effect. So I'm all for it. That's not exactly how it's going to go, because it's not usually a bag and it's not usually brown, but yes.
Oh, then I might have been looking at the wrong thing on my dad's thing. we were eyeballing the wrong thing to take home. Good thing we didn't try.
It's usually some kind of liquid or pill, or either way, yes. I mean, on hospice specifically, now in the hospital, like your dad, right? Your dad, so the reason why they were telling him not to drink is because they didn't want him to have symptoms, because if fluid's not going through your intestines like it should, you'll start getting pain and then you'll start vomiting. Mm-hmm. So they will restrict what you're having. Hence why he was like, I'm thirsty, and they won't let him have anything. That wouldn't really happen on hospice because we're more for comfort. However, because it would be uncomfortable if he did chug a lot of water because his intestines weren't working, we would educate you guys on that. And really what I would do as a hospice nurse in that point, if he was really saying I'm super thirsty, but he can't really drink, and if he did drink a lot, he'd get sick, I would medicate. Because it's uncomfortable to be thirsty and not be able to drink.
Yeah, I gave him
so
water.
I would medicate then, and I wouldn't say like knock him out. But I mean, just to take the edge off.
No, knock me out.
You're not sitting there
absolutely
being thirsty.
If I'm uncomfortable, knock me out. And if I'd known that... It sounds like we're saying that it's somewhere along the line there when my dad was ill that we could have made a decision to put him in hospice, right? That would have been a choice we could have made. And I never even heard that come up. No one ever even mentioned it. I've heard of hospice, but I guess I thought it was for other people. I don't know. Maybe you've got some sort of illness and they say you are for sure going to die and you got, you know, a month to live. And because you got a month to live and that's it, you're going to be in a lot of pain. We'll put you in hospice. Like, that's what I thought of.
I mean, I guess we're kicking around. You're a hospice nurse. And I want to get more to that about how we die and what it feels like and how we can talk about it and the things we can say. But when my dad passed away, what I noticed, and I think you're kind of getting at too, is that there wasn't one guy in charge or girl in charge. There was, hey, you've got this problem going on, and so
a specialist
would come in. Then you've got another one coming in for, you got this thing going on, and then an oncologist comes in like, man, I think you might have lung cancer too, but I don't know. But
it's like, who's his doctor?
Right,
the actual
and then
doctor.
Like, who's the one in charge? It's like, all right, let's look at all of these files and just put a big fuck stamp on it and send him to hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but instead, it's like the oncologist is like, I think I can cure the lung cancer, boys.
Yeah.
But then the other one's like, we can't fucking get chemo because he can't, right? And then they're like, okay, whatever. And then they just kind of like, no one's there to say they all think they can cure their one issue.
Amen.
But there's 18 issues, you know?
Yes. And you're waiting for specialists all the time. You spend all that time waiting for specialists.
And I get it. The doctor's like, hey, I'm an oncologist, man. It looks like he has lung cancer, but it's not that much. I can cure that shit.
Right.
And I get it. That's his job, and he's a specialist. But then there's another guy who's like, yeah, but he's a diabetic, and he's got a foot wound. We got to put this airbag on his foot. He doesn't know anything about lung cancer, right?
Mm-hmm. Listen, you're talking to, like, this is one of my number one things. Like, no one's talking to anyone in the hospitals. Again, I'm not trying to, like, blame the healthcare workers. It's like the system we're brought up in, where it's like you stay in your own lane, you deal with your own thing. Meanwhile, here's a person who's, I mean, I'm not saying your dad, anyone. Here's an 80-year-old person who has a bunch of shit going on,
mm-hmm.
a bunch of shit.
Right.
And no one's looking at the whole person as like, okay, well, let's really think this through. Like, even if we do the surgery for cancer, are his kidneys okay to really make it? Does he even want it?
Right,
What's his life going to look like after this? Can he handle the chemo?
It's a shitty situation. Dying in a hospital sucks, and it's just not something that I was prepared for.
And I get what you're saying. You don't want to blame the doctors, because the doctor is literally a cancer doctor.
Yes.
And so when they come in, he's like, yo, why are we sending this guy to hospice? He's got cancer, but I fix this all fucking day, baby.
Right.
And then somebody else is like, but look at his clogged arteries. Like, I'm a heart surgeon. This is easy.
Right.
But they don't, you know what I mean? But like, again, we said, there's a bunch of people, and I don't even know if they... I don't know if they don't communicate, just like, well, what? I don't know who's making the decision, but what I'm telling you right now, if I'm the heart doctor, I'm like, well, I don't know who makes the decision to let this guy go, but if you're basing it on his heart problems, I can have that fixed in an hour in surgery, right?
Yep.
So I think he just walks away and like, well, somebody else is going to make that decision, but I can fix what I got to fix.
Yeah.
Who can't fix it?
Right. The people are nice. The people are smart.
Everybody individually is like, I can fix it.
Yeah.
But together they can't.
It's just the system overall sucks. Right.
It takes time. Okay, so talking about death, because we're all so scared of it, right?
Yeah.
Including healthcare professionals. I was an ICU nurse for 8 years, which is like the opposite of a hospice nurse. And we just didn't, it's like you avoid death at all costs, right? So that's what everyone's thinking. No one has the time. It takes time to talk to a family, get them all together, explain what's really happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And be the one to say, I think we're coming to the end here. That's hard to do. And it takes time to ease people into it. You can't be callous. You can't just go, I think your dad's dying. See ya. So no one does it. No one does it because they don't have the time to do it, first off. And they think it's someone else's job, probably. Or they think, maybe I don't know. Maybe I don't know the full story. Maybe this guy really is healthy. Maybe he's not ready. Maybe someone else already talked to him about it. And hence, we run into these problems where...
Right. Do you think the fourth or fifth reason is that in order to do that job, I can't imagine... including you, and although obviously it feels like you've taken a different route, I can't imagine how you can't turn off your feelings.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just carry that around every day, and you are one of those people who, you know, was in charge of whatever that disease is, that pancreatic cancer doctor, right? If you're that guy, mm-hmm. I don't see how you bring that home. You don't bring that home every day after six until you just almost become... I hate to say it, but like a mafia hitman, like it happens so much and I do this so often that I can't fucking feel it anymore. Because if I do feel it, I'll drive myself crazy.
You have to disassociate.
Right.
I know. I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I know as a hospice or not a hospice nurse. I know as an ICU nurse, I definitely disassociated like completely. And I hated it. I had compassion fatigue. I had burnout.
PTSD?
It's like you
I just assume these people have PTSD, right? Too, from this, you know, from all that disassociating and seeing all that trauma.
Yeah. I think, too, there's just some... It's like... I think most people, I will say, most people are doing the best they can. I don't think anyone's truly being like, I don't give a shit. You know, I think they just are doing the best they can and working within a system that probably feels too big to grapple, right? Like, it's like, yeah, I know, I can see how an oncologist would be like, I know there's a problem here. I know, but it's like, it's too big to take on.
Right.
You know, that's how I felt.
Right.
That's how I felt.
And again, we're talking to Nurse Julie, Julie McFadden, and she's a huge now internet celebrity, and she's got a book coming out. But, you know, as you're talking about these nurses, I do want to make it clear, and just the healthcare workers, that we were so frustrated in that situation with my dad in the hospital. I mean, so frustrated. But each person individually was a kind person.
Sure.
And something really interesting that happened is when they did say, this is it, this is the end, and, you know, your dad's probably going to die sometime today, and we're all gathered there, we're all just watching and waiting. The nurse who was, you know, working that shift, I had not seen that nurse before. This is not a nurse that my dad had had up to that point. But this was the nurse that happened to be on shift at that time. When my dad passed away after it was over, I noticed that myself, my brothers, and my mom, we all went and said something to this nurse, and a couple of us hugged him. You know, my mom hugged this nurse in tears. It was like we had this connection to this nurse who we only had just met a couple of hours ago, but now we felt like we shared this thing with him. He was the one who was there with us. He was the one who was, and I, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, if we had had a hospice type situation, someone that we'd been, you know, interacting with for days or the weeks that he was sick, I can't imagine how close we would feel to that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you get that? You know what I mean? Do you have people that just, they feel like they share this with you, and you, and I don't know, maybe you feel like you share it with them as well.
Yeah. I mean, people think hospice nursing is depressing. It's, and I can say ICU nursing was far more depressing. It was horrific. Even though people are dying, all of my patients will die.
Have you ever had one not?
Right.
Just by the way you said that.
I'm not playing around.
Have you ever had one in hospice and all of a sudden they're like, what the fuck? They just get up and walk out? Like, this is bullshit. I'm out.
I've had one miracle happen, which I can say in 1 second. But okay. But she still did die. But
no.
But yeah, everyone does die. Now, some people take longer. Some people do come off hospice.
Okay.
Because they have some kind of like chronic, like Alzheimer's or dementia or diseases that kind of wax and wane. They're ultimately terminal, but they can wax and wane in how bad they are. So people can come off hospice, but they usually will go back on hospice with the same disease and eventually die. Yes. But my whole point of saying all this is that even though they're all dying and it seems like, oh, that'd be so sad, that'd be so hard, it's like I get to witness so much love and care from the families, and the death is not, like I said, it's not usually painful, right? So they're usually eventually very comfortable, and it's like this peaceful, dare I say, beautiful death. And then I get to watch all the love from the families, and it's not my grief, right? Like, so I really keep it separate. Like, this is their, I'm there to support them. I'm not going to make it about me and like, oh, I'm sad because I'm losing this person that I took care of. Like, it's not about me. It's about them.
Yeah, but the gratitude that they have for you, that they weren't expecting, that, you know, it's not something that they thought about, but that gratitude that they have for you, it kind of feels like love in that moment, because it is something so personal and so, you know, tragic, but also, like you said, a part of life, that there is this just immense sense of gratitude. Thank you for being this person who was here at this time and being a good person. You know, gosh, I'm lucky. So I imagine that you get that. And that must be, you know, a good part of your job.
Yes, you got it. There it is. That's exactly right.
So what was the miracle? She had dementia and then suddenly she was president, or what happened?
No. So the miracle was, it was a young person dying. Young enough that they had, children in their like early 20s. So they're probably in their 50s. To me, that's young.
To everyone, and, I think.
Yes, of course. But it has meant like they weren't like 18, anyway. And I got to their house. It was a late admission. So they were just coming onto hospice and I was doing the first visit. It's called the admission visit, or the start of care. And when she arrived, I saw it coming from the ambulance because she was coming from the hospital. I could see right away she was actively dying, which means the very, very last phase of life. She's unconscious, changes in breathing, changes in skin color. Like, that's just a sign that hospice nurses know what that means. It means they're dying probably that day, maybe a couple of days. And I was like, oh, boy, because she had young kids. They were asking me about, like, oh, when can she eat again? When can she walk again? Are we going to get physical therapy for her? So I knew they didn't really know what was going on because she definitely wasn't eating and walking again. She was going to die that night, I thought. So anyway, I got her situated, and I had to, like, basically break the news to the children that, like, she's dying and she's probably going to die that night, and to get people over there and how we're going to help and all the things. So we got her situated. She was really comfortable. The kids obviously are upset, but they knew what was going on. And I basically told them to call us when she died, because we're a 24-hour service. So when she does die, we can go and help them, and went home, and that was it. And I thought she'd die that night. I mean, certain, like, there was no doubt in my mind that she wouldn't die.
Okay.
Because I thought she was going to die during the visit. She was, like, taking some of her last breaths, it looked like. So the next morning, when I didn't see from my office that there was no death calls, like, no one had gone out, the on-call nurses, and I was like, what the hell? Why? What happened, you know? And I called the family to be like, how'd you guys do overnight? What's going on, you know? Oh, last night was great. Mom slept through the night. Now she woke up, she said she was hungry, so she's out in the kitchen, and she's eating pancakes.
Wow.
And what are you like, what
the? Like, oh, I mean, I think I hit it pretty well, but I literally, my jaw was to the floor. Like,
right.
Did I call the right number? Like, who am I speaking with? What
no,
the
no,
hell
no, not the lady
about?
Eating pancakes. the one that's dying.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, your mom's awake? And they're like, yeah. And I could hear her laughing in the background. I could hear her.
Wow.
And I was like, I got to see this.
Obviously. So you went over there?
Yes. So I was like, well, I'm going to come make a visit, because I'm like, I cannot believe this.
You get over there, and it turns out they're doing Weekend at Bernie's.
They got her arms around her, tied up, and like, see?
She's eating pancakes.
We don't talk about death here. She's dancing, making pancakes, baby.
Weekend at Bernie's. Oh, my God, you guys are hilarious. I get there, sure as shit, she is up and awake and smiling and eating.
Wow.
And so there is a phenomenon called the rally, where, like, someone has a burst of energy right before they die, where they, like, change and they look like they're, like, fully better.
Yeah, we call it
now,
Adderall.
This would have been... Oh, my God. You guys...
It's like a puking rally when you're drunk, too.
Yeah,
you're
like,
fuck, that dude is out on the couch. And then you go outside and smoke a joint. You come back, and he's standing up.
Tapping the keg again, and you're
listening
like,
to Soundgarden. You're like, fucking, hey, puking rally, bro. Same thing. Oh, she just puked death and rally. That's what she did.
She death and rally. That's right. That's right. Of course, then I'm like the friggin' angel of death over here, going to the house being like, listen, kids, like, she's probably going to die soon.
Right.
So I'm thinking it's some kind of big burst of energy rally type stuff like that. I've never... Now, normally the rally wouldn't be that drastic, so I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on, but maybe it's the rally. So, of course, I'm like, wah, wah, bad news. You're probably going to die. Like, next, because it usually only lasts for, like, a day or so.
Right.
But I was wrong again. This lady lived walking, talking, eating, laughing, doing whatever the hell she wanted for 3 months, which I know is still not long.
Well, that's a lot longer.
It's long when you're dying.
It's long when you're dying, and from what I saw, she was... on death's door. I mean, last breath type of death. And she lived for three more months. So that's my miracle story.
Well, yeah. So what? Why shouldn't we? Let me just, because it feels like we got into a lot of different stuff. But why shouldn't we be scared to die? I understand that it's not painful.
Yeah.
That you can control the pain.
Yes.
But I'll why shouldn't we be scared?
I will say this. It's not that you shouldn't be scared. It's that it's okay that you feel scared. And just because you feel scared doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it and prepare for it. Because from my experience, what I have found, people who are willing to do that, even if they're scared, even if they still feel scared after they talk about it, there is something about, it's like, it's like what we resist persists, right? So sure. We're resisting this thing. I'm scared. It almost, that makes it more scary.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about it.
We fear the fear.
What when you talk to people and they're telling you that, what are most people scared of? I find that fascinating. Are they scared of, like, what happens in the afterlife? Are they scared of, you know, heaven or hell? What are people scared of?
Missing out? Because you talk about that last week.
Well, that's mine. Like people say, are you scared to die? And I'm not scared to die. I mean, I don't like the idea of dying, right? Like you said, that idea of slowly becoming weaker and weaker and weaker, and especially if it was drawn out over years, which in some ways is great because you get to spend time with your family. I'm scared to put that burden on my children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to do that to them. Then the other part of that is, you know, it just sucks. Like, in the sense that I really like watching my kids grow up.
Yep.
And so, you know, you'd have to somehow deal with that. So it's not necessarily, it's a scared thing of that I don't get to enjoy these things anymore.
And the world's going to go on without me. My family's going to go on without me. I'm going to miss
that. And it's just, you know, all of that, I'm going to miss all these. No matter how many big steps I saw in my kids' lives, I'm going to miss these. You know, there's always more things coming. And so it's not, you know, I'm not scared of, like, am I going to go to hell or what? I don't fucking know. And I think that is, like, way too much to get wrapped up in. If there is a heaven and hell and I end up, I mean, I believe in something, but I end up and they're like, hey, you fucked that all up. I'd be like, well, you could have left better information.
Right.
Like, I did my best. Like, fucking, what's working out
mixed
now?
Messages.
Like, it seemed odd. Like, there's a lot of shit going on down here, man. You might want to stop back in and then clear a couple of misconceptions up. I believed in you, but I don't know what the fuck you're trying to tell me. But, so that part doesn't scare me, but, you know, I guess more saddens me to miss those moments with the people that I love.
Yeah, I think it's all of those things. I think some people are actually afraid of, like, what's going to happen afterwards. Some people say that to me. Some people will say, I'm not really afraid, but I'm afraid of, like, suffering or the actual process of dying. Some people say what you say, I'm just afraid of not being with my children or my family or whoever, you know, whoever they're going to miss. It's all of those things. And
are you afraid to die?
From someone who sees death all the time, I see it all the time, right? Because I see it all the time, I am not really afraid of death anymore. I'm still going to have a human experience where if I get diagnosed with something terminal tomorrow, I'm still going to feel anger and sadness and fear and all the things, anxiety I'm going to have because I'm still human. But
you think you're in a better position if you and I go to the doctor tomorrow and we both get the same terminal diagnosis, you believe that you will handle that better than I will. And just so you know, the way I will handle it is to pass out on the floor and wet myself and then I'll just cry and they'll be pumping me full of sedatives for the next month.
Yes, I will handle it better. No offense.
Okay. No, that's fine. It's good. I need to see strong people.
Yes. I will handle it better because I've seen it so many times and truly watch it. It feels like a birth. Like I've only seen a few babies being born, but when I did, it was like, oh, you know, like this magical moment of like, now there's a baby and it's like, where'd you come from? Oh my God. Inside a person. Like it's wild. Right. And like my feeling was like, oh my God, like time stood still. It's hard not to cry. Happy tears of seeing this baby. Not my own, like just random, whatever, but I don't have kids, but, just that process. Right.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, because I think I don't have the grief, it's not my dad, it's not my mom. When I watch someone take their last breath, it feels a little like that.
Well, I did have the grief. It was my dad, and I did feel this sense of peace. We were there. We were lucky enough to know and get to say our last goodbyes, but we were standing in the room, and, you know, it sounds callous, but waiting for him to die. And as we were standing around kind of watching him, there was this sense that there was something that I think my brothers and family would agree there, that we, it was almost like we felt something. And I look at his face and my brothers look at his face and we at the same time are like, he's gone. And it was quite peaceful. And it was almost like the sense of relief, the pain, all those things are over. But also I wasn't expecting that, whatever that was I just sensed that like that.
Yeah,
he's not here anymore. And it was something that I feared my whole life because my dad was older and kids made fun of me for it. I was always scared of my parents dying. So when it actually happened, the fact that I could you know, get through it was, I don't know how to explain it in words, but I guess peaceful is one way, but also in some ways just surprising that, oh, this is something that I can handle. I can deal with, and this is not the end of the world, you know? And so yeah, I don't think it's crazy, even if it's someone that you love.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your book, because...
Wait, real quick. I do have one more question. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the book, and we're talking to Julie McFadden, and the book is called Nothing to Fear. But one thing that I'm curious about, and you say end of life, and you're going, and that usually comes with a diagnosis from a doctor or someone saying, this person's terminal and can't be helped anymore, right? Like, we've done everything we can at the hospital. But
usually that's how it goes, yeah.
Right, but what about, you know, euthanasia? What about that? What about I want to die with dignity? I don't want to have to go through all these things, because I feel like for someone like me, who's not necessarily scared of the afterlife, but scared of what that does to their family and puts the burden on them. And then
scared of dying.
Right. And then, right, so, you know, just the process, and I'm not scared of deteriorating myself, I guess. I'm more scared of, like, what my boys would have to go through to watch, to see that happen. And I know they would say, live as long as you can, Dad, we'll do whatever we got. But also, at some point, you have to be that person, be like, man, I don't want to put you through that. It doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah.
And I'd rather just go, I'd rather be as, have as much fun as we can until it comes to that point to where this is no longer fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And let's make, you know, our memories be that last part of fun, not this next 30 days, which are going to be horrifying. Why can't we do that? And I guess I know we can in some states, but that seems very, very odd to me that the only person who can do that is a doctor after they've tried everything.
Right. Well, welcome to America.
Right.
I mean, don't get me started.
Well, I just did.
Why can't we do that? Why can't we? Exactly. Why can't we do that? I don't know. It's insane. We should be able to do that. I completely agree with you. We should be able to do that in every state easily. Now, this is totally one of my passions, if you couldn't tell. But I live in California, so it is legal here. So people do that. And but it's still really hard to get the medication. You know, there's a bunch of hoops you have to jump through, a bunch of things that people have to sign off to do it, you know, once you can get it. And I think it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. It's a way to take back control if you're someone who likes control, which most people do. And the times I've witnessed, it's been amazing and beautiful and a great asset to our healthcare system, I think.
I think it would take a strength that I don't have. I watched that documentary where someone was doing that. It was the last 24 hours of her life. And I could not believe, this was actually happening in another country. I think she was in the Netherlands. And I couldn't believe how just calm she was. She was making the journalist a cup of tea the night before and everything. It just seemed totally normal. And then she, and I'm like, what's wrong with this woman? I mean, she was elderly, but she was getting around fine and all those things. And then she goes in and she lays down on the bed and her family comes in and they did it. And I was so moved by that. And I don't know if it was fear, if it was, but I thought, my God, I do not have the strength that that woman possesses. How do you get that strength? Where does that come from?
Well, I think you don't have to, not everybody would have that strength. And maybe I wouldn't, but when I think about it, I think, like you said, that's a way to handle this. And right. And to
maybe you're doing it
and to
kids.
Reduce some of your pain and to reduce the people that you love stress and pain. Like that is a, you know, and by the way, I'm not saying everybody should do it. I'm just saying in my mind, that makes a lot more sense to be able to handle it like this. And it takes away. I use an analogy a lot. And sorry to bore you with this, but in baseball, in Fenway Park in Boston, there's a thing called the Green Monster. The Green Monster is a wall, and a lot of baseballs get hit off that wall. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at the stats, most home runs in any other stadium are hit higher than that wall anyway. So what's there then? So what's there? What's there is this wall standing in front of you, and you're scared you're not going to hit it high enough over the wall. But if that wall wasn't there, you would hit it higher over the wall. So you're scared of a green monster that truly only exists in your head. Mm-hmm. And so I think, to me, that's death. Death is the green monster. Death is me standing there being so scared of something that probably when I get to the plate, I probably shouldn't be that scared. And I probably won't be nearly as scared as I think I am now. And I've spent my entire life fucking worried about something that probably isn't going to be. Now, I'm not saying some death can't be cruel and horrible and horrifying for people, but probably for the person involved, it's probably not as bad as the fear of worrying about it your entire fucking life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think there's probably listeners being like, I think some people who did experience their loved one having a horrible death, they'd listen to this and be like, F you, it was horrific, it was this, da, da, da. So I think that is, I think obviously that's a thing. And how can
you're saying is it wouldn't
then?
Be a thing if...
If they
could go to hospice.
And we could just talk about it. Or not even, I don't care if you go to hospice, because I think hospice is great. But, like, I just need to be like, you guys, can we please, we prepare for everything in life for the most part.
Right.
Why can't, we need to prepare for the biggest thing that's going to happen to all of us. And I think the end-of-life medication, the death with dignity medication, where people drink medication knowing they're going to die, there's something with that where it's like, it's black and white. They know it's happening. So now they can plan for it. Now they have their family over. Now they can have a sense of peace because they know it's coming. And I think if we could just look at death in general like that, like we know it's coming. Like because there's no control and we don't know, that also creates tons of anxiety. Hence why we want to avoid it.
But wouldn't a lot of that, I guess, not to go back to it, but a lot of that, of people who died, you know, a horrible death and had, well, I guess, loved ones of people who have. Wouldn't a lot of that alleviate itself if we did talk about it and then did go to hospice or, you know, a die with dignity center? I don't know what that's called, but one of these things, we would have less of that pain in terror, right?
Yes. And if we knew what death and dying actually looked like, a lot of times people will say to me, oh my gosh, my loved one suffered. It was horrific. I watched them die for 5 days. And then I'd ask them, like, what happened? What it looked like? Why did they think they suffered so much? And then they'll explain to me exactly what an actively dying person looks like. And really, everything that they witnessed and saw was very normal. And their loved one likely wasn't suffering. But because they're not used to seeing it, and it can feel really scary if you don't know why things are happening and what's going on, they take that and they make it into this story of, like, and again, I don't want to, like, not validate them, but the story of, like, tragedy and torture, when really what they were seeing was what death looks like. Yeah. But we just don't know it because we don't show it anywhere.
My dad kept trying to eat cotton balls.
So did my dad.
My dad was eating cotton balls, and he kept saying, give me these goddamn Oreos.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And we were like, Dad, they're cotton balls. And then 10 minutes later, he's like, give me a fucking Oreo, man.
Right.
I'm like,
all right. Let's get him some actual Oreos.
Right, that's why I was like, somebody go upstairs and get this motherfucker an Oreo.
Well, Nurse Julie, I assume this is part of why you wrote this book, Nothing to Fear, which comes out in June. And I'm very curious, you know, you go, I don't know what your original intention was when you go on social media and you think, I want to talk about hospice. I assume that it's to get us talking about death so that we can start having conversations like the one that we're having. But you get this, you amass this following on social media. And the next thing you know, you're getting called by one of the biggest publishers in the world, the same people that published the Royal Family's memoirs. I mean, this isn't like, you know, a self-published book. And like, hey, you want to write a book? I mean, what did you ever think that these videos that you were posting could lead to this?
No, this is truly, I've been just sort of like riding this strange wave. I have not tried to like make this happen. It all just sort of keeps unfolding. And I'm just trying to go with it best I can. Just trying to go with it and stick to my original thought, which was, I just want to educate people about death and dying, help demystify all the things. And here we are. I have a book coming out. It's wild.
On the synopsis that we got for the book, one of the things that it mentions was that a lot of things that we've already covered, but one of the things was you said that you want to work on the language that we use around death, like the language that we should use versus the language that we do use. What kind of language? Can you give me examples? I'm not sure I know exactly what that means.
Yeah, well, I just think I think we need to say death, dying, dead. I think I always say, like, death is not a dirty word. I mean, I don't just say that. Many people say that. But death is not a dirty word. Saying someone died is not bad. And I think we look at that word as, like, the ultimate. And I know that it can feel harsh. And that's why people say so-and-so passed away. That's why I don't really correct everybody. The whole passed away thing, I get it. It doesn't feel as harsh. And grief is involved in all of this.
Yeah.
And is there a world where we can start saying those words slowly but surely, saying so and so has died, especially if we work in the healthcare system, like we as nurses and doctors,
what do they say?
Need to be saying. Well, they can say like he's gone.
It's his time. It was his time.
It's time.
But what does a doctor say to? I know you would say that to me, but what does a doctor say to a nurse when someone dies? They say the same thing. Are they like?
No, they say we are so much more real with each other, which is also something that annoys me because we should be real with everybody.
Right.
And no, they would say they died.
You know, okay.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was just, but to the, you know, they just try to, and by the way, I mean, I don't have any issues with doctors, you know, it's like, I know, you know, they're doing their best. So maybe they'd be like, well, I should say this person died. But we're not there yet, and if I say die, it's going to, you know...
I don't want to be the one that starts it.
I hurt this lady's fucking feelings. I just say passed away, right? Like, yeah, I'd like for the world to change, but it ain't changing, and Jeff just died, and his wife's out here, so I'll say...
Passed away.
Crept away in the night.
Right. Moved to an ex-astral plane.
Right.
Yeah. I do get it, and I still do it sometimes, too. You have to read the room. You have to read the room. You can't just be this, like, super harsh person trying to push an agenda, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not.
But I think if you're getting this information out, we can all slowly get to that point.
We can all slowly get there.
Right.
Yes.
And then it does, like, nobody's saying it's going to happen today to someone who died, but maybe with the people who are watching your TikTok videos and reading your book, maybe in 20 years, we do get to that spot. And wouldn't that be easier for everybody?
Right. And especially if, because I generally teach to, like, the masses. I'm not really teaching to healthcare workers. They already know the stuff I'm saying.
Right.
So I feel like if we as a culture start kind of changing the way we think, that's also going to change healthcare.
Okay.
You know, healthcare is going to move with what we're doing.
When you die, when you get sick, you better
be tough.
Have some fucking dignity.
Yeah, you better be tough. You talked
everybody's
a lot of
watching
shit.
You. Yeah, you're like, please.
You start
nothing
crying.
To be scared about.
Oh, right.
Used to be words, and all of a sudden you just, you're the one who passes out and pisses the pants. Because you'll freak us all out if you do that.
Put... Take him, not me.
I need to put my money where my mouth is.
Right.
I've thought about it. Believe me.
I have a question for you, and I don't know if you'll have the answer, but we were talking about why is it that we individually fear death, because everyone fears death. I think, you know, the number one instinct in life is don't die, right? That's what your brain is telling you all the time. Everything we do is make sure we stay alive, don't die. But I can trace back some fears, at least, to being a kid and watching Tales from the Crypt, and there was an episode where this guy dies, and they put him in a body bag, they take him to the morgue, when they pull him out of the thing and they're going to do an autopsy on him, he is conscious, like he can see, he can hear, he can feel, but he can't move because he's dead. And, of course, they don't know that he has all of his senses about him. And, of course, that scared me quite a bit as a kid. Now, I don't think that is what's going to happen, but I think there is some lingering fears there about consciousness and nothingness. And I don't know if you have the answer to this, but one of the things that's always scared me is when people say, well, you know, when you write your living will, you need to say, you know, when you're going to be taken off life support, whatever. And my thing is, if my life is going to be, you know, we'll put it on the list here. If this is what my life is going to be like, then when take me off. But if I'm just in a coma, well, okay, you can leave me on there. But also don't let me stay in that coma for too long, because I have a really bad fear, Because I've heard from some people who've been in comas, even some of these people who got in a car accident going to a Fleetwood Mac show in 77, and they're in a coma for 20 years.
That's oddly specific.
It was a true story. Okay. And they were in a coma for however many years, and then you find out later, they said, no, I was aware. Do you have any evidence that people are aware?
Speaking of death, I have talked to both my boys about that and said, look, if I'm in a coma, and they're like, they're staying alive. You fucking change the TV station.
Exactly. Dude.
I'm like, you gotta change that. I've told them that. And they're like, what? I'm like, put on like MLB Network or something.
Something
that changes. You know what I mean? I can't.
Yeah. Listen to the Cooking
Network.
Don't just
put on, fucking
SpongeBob
and leave that shit on because Dad doesn't fucking understand anything. Because
right. I might.
I might. I'd be real pissed, but
and
I can't
tell
you. Don't
come in the room and talk about me dying. Like, oh, he looks like shit, and I don't think he has much time. Don't say that because I might hear you, right?
So
I
hope if that. You're, can people hear?
Yes.
God! Damn it!
I know.
Shit.
Wait. I have good news. It's good news and bad news. All of it. This is all good, by the way. Just so you know, I'm so happy that you guys are talking to your family and talking, even if it is in passing and casual and kind of funny, it's still good because at least they're going to know what you want. And I want The Office playing, the show The Office.
Oh, right.
I want Forensic Files.
And being very, 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 very sedated.
I want like sports or something just because it'll change.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want it to run the same thing. I want it to be like, okay, good. It's a new baseball game. I'm really afraid of. I know people are afraid of dying. I'm really afraid of reruns and fucking the same thing over and over again.
So, yes, we do think people can hear at the end of life or if they're in a coma. One, because there has been EEGs done that show that the hearing center of the brain is the thing that shuts down last. Now, how much are they really cognizant? It's not, I don't think it's truly like, oh, I'm fully aware, but no one knows I am. I don't think it's really like that. I think it's from what we hear, because people have come back out of comas and told us, it's mostly like an awareness. There is an awareness of things, and you're kind of in and out of consciousness.
So do you warn people? Like, if this woman's in a coma and the husband's coming in and he's bringing his mistress, are you like, hey, don't bring your mistress. I know she's in a coma, but I think she can hear you guys talking.
Yeah, if you have the balls enough to say that. I mean, I always did.
Okay.
I always said, like, people can hear you. Don't talk about I always say, don't talk about them like they're not here.
Okay.
Like, talk to them like they are going to respond to you, even if they don't. Or you can
say, I need to write in my living will, make sure that if he's in a coma, keep telling him, hey, man, they're about to get you down here. You're fine. Nothing wrong here. Definitely not terminal. Just like I said on the battlefield when I'm conscious. Right. Same thing. Keep telling him he's fine, and he'll be up and out of here in just a couple minutes.
If you die before me, I'll come in and say you're not even in the hospital. We are fucking wasted right now in Vegas.
I'll believe you.
Look, dude, you're not even sick. Why? Get up, man. We got to get the fuck out of here. We're in so much trouble. I'll just give you a whole story like that.
You guys are cracking me up.
Oh, good.
I need to listen to your radio show. I'm sorry to say that. I don't know if I can. Can I listen to it in California?
Absolutely.
Of course you can.
Okay.
So, but this evidence, you've seen this evidence that people can hear, and you've got, it sounds to me like some sort of experience that tells you, yeah, I'm fairly confident that maybe not all, but at least some know exactly what's being said. You've seen it firsthand.
Yeah, and I think, like, I know, this is just my belief, and I would never push this on anybody, so it doesn't really matter, but I think most people know they're dying to an extent. So, like, I know you say, like, oh, if I'm laying there, tell me I'm okay. I feel like we kind of dip into a different consciousness where we kind of know. Our body's letting us know what's going on. I think we have built-in mechanisms that kind of make us feel okay with it. That's what I think, most of the time. Every once in a while, there's people that really, really struggle, I think, because of, like, existential stuff. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that I really wish, like, man, you got to talk about this, you got to prepare for this, because I think you'll have a lot less of that if you do.
Well, I'm glad that we have those built-in mechanisms, but do I need to write down in my living will, like, I also still want the heroin? Be sure you give that to me as well.
Yeah.
And is that, when you're in hospice, I know it's different than dying in the ICU, and that's what we've been discussing, but when you're in hospice and it's the end of life, even if you're not in, let's say that there's no reason to believe this person's in a lot of pain. No, I am curious.
It just made me laugh that you're like, you're going to have to write down, give me drugs.
Right.
If there's just two people in the world that are in the hospital and they ask anyone that knows us,
right,
like, do you think he'd like the drugs? Not one person who knows us would be like, you know what, I'm not sure.
And tell them about my tolerance, please.
They're all going to be like, yes, they want the fucking drugs. Believe me, they want the drugs.
But
they took their own before they got here. They're fucking on drugs now. I've never seen them not on drugs.
Exactly. But I am curious, when people are dying, even if they're not in pain, if there is some sort of like protocol, they say, okay, this person is on their way out, and so when they're on their way out, these are the things we usually give them to help them on their way out, whether it's in the ICU or hospice. Or does that just vary?
Okay, so ICU probably, because they're usually connected to machines and stuff. So ICU, I feel like probably. Now hospice, we are very lenient. There will likely always be drugs in the house, just in cases. So there are many people.
Like my house.
Yeah, I was going to say, same girl.
There are many people that do not die in pain. I mean, there are so many people that I have taken care of, many people that have not gotten a single thing of medicine because they didn't need it. They're really, I mean, I get it. I have that personality too. I don't care if I'm in pain or not. Give me it.
But I thought that was the rules in America. Like that's how we, you know, send people off here.
There are people that die very easily and peacefully without any medicine.
But that doesn't make it right. I'm just saying that, like, I thought that we had some sort of protocol that they said, okay, this person's on their way out, we're going to give them some drugs on their way out.
Why isn't it right?
Because in my mind, I'm thinking, we don't know exactly what this person might be feeling or thinking, but we do know that if we give them some drugs, they'll feel good.
You think we do know exactly what they're feeling?
We do, yes. As healthcare workers, it's very, very easy to tell if someone is struggling or if they're not. It's very easy to tell.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, and believe me, I'm not anti-drugs. I'm all about it. But what I would like, but there's a misconception that hospice just loads people with drugs until they die, which many people don't like. They think hospice just killed my loved one, and that's not what's happening. So No, there's no protocol because people don't need it if they're not in pain. But we're also very lax. So if it's someone like you who's like, give me all the drugs, we will give you the standard. Like, there's a thing called a comfort pack. Most hospice companies will give you this thing called a comfort pack. And In that comfort pack, there is drugs like that.
Okay.
And
double it up.
You can use them as prescribed.
I'm going to need the double comfort.
That regular comfort pack is not going to be enough for me. Okay. I need to sign in at a different level. I'm just curious.
You know, it's funny. Real quick. Sorry to interrupt you again. But, you know, we said, like, why are people scared of death? And we talked about all that. And Slim, you talked about Tales from the Crypt. But also, like, what's the biggest fear in movies? Or if, like, you can't even tell someone, like, you, like, literally you can't say, I'll fucking kill you.
Right.
You could say, I mean, right? I mean,
it's a threat.
And Movies, like, the biggest fear is, like, what is every bad thing? Like, anything you're scared of is just death.
Well, death and loss, because it doesn't even have to be your death. It's either your death or losing someone else.
Everything's scared of death, right? Horror movies are about death. Right, everything's... Right. If it's a sad or scary movie, what you're threatened with is death, right?
Yep.
If everybody was like, "Ah, death's no big deal," that's what happens. Like, Hollywood would be fucked to some degree, right? Because that just to me proves that we're all scared of it, which goes back to
survival instinct.
Right. My thing that everybody gets mad at me about, and people were mentioning it on Twitch, is that I want us all to die at once.
Which is so crazy. He can't just let us go on living.
Right. I want a nuke to hit us all. So it's so much easier if we're all fucking dealing with it. Like, shit, I'm going to die. Like, me too, man. Like, yeah, fuck. We better.
I don't want that.
You want
to know that we're getting nuked? You don't want to just get nuked suddenly?
Would be ideal. But as long as we're all doing it together, my fear is like everybody else is like going to Olive Garden when they leave the room. I feel bad for them. They're at Olive Garden, and I'm like, fuck. I got to stay in this fucking bed. I'm fucking dying. Everybody else is fucking hospitaliano, fucking breadsticks and shit.
I'm the one who told them to order the extra marinara and the cheese with the free breadsticks.
Now, here I am. They're all fucking gone. I'm fucking sitting here.
I've never understood that one. That's one that I don't.
Comfort pack. I don't like dying alone. And I know everybody dies alone, but I don't like dying alone.
Yeah, but that's a weird one that I never totally understood. Because I don't have... Usually we agree on that stuff, but that's not one that...
Yeah, but if we all do it together, it feels... Anything you do with a group is better.
But well, I feel like I'm still dying alone.
It's the unknown. Yeah. People love knowing. I mean, I really do think it's as simple as that. I know there's complicated emotions around it. Generally speaking, I think people don't like not knowing. People love living in the black and white. I do too. This happens, then this happens, then this. Like and because it's such an unknown, we can't compute. Then it makes us very uncomfortable. No one likes to feel uncomfortable. We all want to feel like only good feelings. If it doesn't feel comfortable, then it must be bad.
Yeah, we can't comprehend nothingness. And if we try and comprehend nothingness, it manifests usually as darkness, right? Like, oh, yeah. No, but that's not being able to see. That's not nothingness. Right. And so it's just so hard to comprehend that.
Well, it's the one last thing we can't kind of explain, right? I mean, like, if we go back and look at, like, Greek mythology, they had a god of sun. Why did they have a god of sun? Because they didn't fucking understand what the sun was. They had a god of love. Why did they have a god of love? Because they couldn't fucking explain love, right? They had all these different gods of war and a million different gods for things that they couldn't understand. But what do we? What does everybody still have a god for?
Afterlife.
The one thing we can't prove.
Yeah, the one thing we can't prove.
So we're like, hey, we got rid of all the gods of moons and oceans and suns because science kind of figured it all out. They're like, hey, scientists, what happens to us when we're dead? And they're like, well, I don't fucking know. And they're like, well, we need to keep that god. We need to keep that one. And like, I'm not saying there isn't one. I do believe in something. Yeah. But it's obvious to me that that's why we're keeping that one because we're like, fuck. It can't. I gotta go somewhere good.
At the very least, insurance for my soul.
Exactly. Yeah. I gotta go somewhere good. Or if I have a father, a loved one, a child, someone die, I need to know that there's someone good. There's somewhere good, and we can't prove that to you. We can't tell you that, and that's the fear, right?
Yeah.
And
if there's any, so what I would like to say is, being with someone who is around this, like I said, over and over again, I'm around this all the time, right? And I think other hospice workers would agree with me for the most part. Being around death has basically made me not really fear it as much because there is something that's, and not even because like you said, I do believe in something afterwards, but even if I didn't, because I know that's just a belief. I know that there might not be anything afterwards and then that's it. And I'm still not that afraid.
Which is what they said about previous generations. Right. Being around death, they were just not as afraid of death.
I mean, if there is nothing after, then there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of.
Except when you're talking about your family going on without you and those things, and you could be worried about that.
Yeah, but then I guess in my head, my logic kicks in, like, I wouldn't know then.
Right. Well, that's how
you wouldn't know then.
Right.
You wouldn't, right. There is something that I'm telling you that's what made me the most surprised. Like my first year in hospice nursing, I had already been a nurse for almost a decade, right? My first year of hospice nursing blew my freaking mind because I couldn't believe the shit that happened.
Right.
There was some like magical shit that happened. That's also what I mean. But even just the biological things that our body did to help us die, I was like, damn. What the hell? This feels miraculous. Even though we're dying, it still feels miraculous because our bodies are doing so much crazy shit without us even trying.
To help us get through it.
Knowledge does help us with everything.
Then our body kicking off some sort of chemical reactions, what you're saying, and our brain doing something so that we're okay.
Yeah. That's what it appears. That's what it seems like.
So, Nurse Julie, let me just ask you before we let you go. Would you... If you knew you had a month to live, is your ideal scenario then to die at home? Do you think more people should die at home with a nurse there to care for the person? Do you wish more people would choose to die in hospice? What do you think, based on what you've seen as a nurse, what do you think is the better option there?
And not only for the person dying, but for the family, surrounding family.
The
survivors. What should we do when we get that, when we get word?
Okay, so there's so many things. So one, I think we should all, you guys aren't going to like this, but even now, like when you said, Julie, if you had a month to live, I'm not kidding when I tell you, I truly contemplate that almost on a daily basis so I can reframe the way I look at my life. I think we all need to really contemplate our own mortality, whether that's actually happening or not, because it helps me live better. It helps me be more intentional. It helps me be more grateful for the health and life I do have in today,
absolutely.
Right?
So God, when the doctor told me in the fifth grade that I didn't have cancer, I mean, I'd never felt that type of joy and gratitude for life because, you know, I thought that I was sick. I thought it was out of my control. I thought it was I was done. When I found out he was wrong and everything was going to be okay, man, that's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of high that I felt that you can't quite replicate.
Yeah. I don't know your personal situation. I don't know if you're married or if you're close with your family or you have a close family, but do you talk about that with them on a constant basis too?
Yes, they can't stand me.
They're tired. They're talking about it.
They're like, just fucking do it already, Julie.
keep talking about
that. You're always calling. I might die in a month. Like, bitch, it's been 12 years.
I know. My poor parents. I really drive it home with them. But they're coming around. They're coming around. But no, yes, I do that with them. And my sister, my siblings, and my nieces, and my friends. I mean, I am. This is like who I am in my daily life, too. And anyway, so yes, I would, if I had a month to live again, I'd still have all the human experience. I'd still have all the emotions that come along with death and dying and like losing your health and getting debilitated, all the things. And I would love to be in bed at my house, having enough money, which does take money to die well, which is a whole nother thing I could talk about, which irritates me. But, to have like a person here caring for me so my family didn't have to. And I wish I think more people would do that if they knew they were really dying. And I think we do people a disservice in healthcare because we don't say things black and white, because we're afraid, because we don't really know, you know, so we don't want to be like, but probably you're going to die soon. Like, I think people would make that choice a little more if they truly knew what was going to happen to them in the next 6 months because of a certain diagnosis.
And the doctors would never tell you anything. They never say, you're just like Laszlo was saying earlier, you're waiting for someone to give you like okay, here's a conclusion, but no one would ever give it to us. And so then we are left to speculate and it's between the brothers and no, I think he's dying. And we just wanted someone to say, hey, look, let's be honest here. He's not going to leave this hospital.
Right.
You know, and I don't know how long he's going to be alive, but he's not going to leave this hospital. Someone needed to tell us that and they didn't.
Yes.
I don't know if it's because they couldn't or what, but they just didn't.
Well, I think, again, like, that's what I mean. I hate to be like, they're lying. I don't think they're truly trying to lie. I think it's never been taught how to do it. They always, it's kind of like, but maybe not, right? So they don't want to be the one to be like, no, for sure.
Well, I'm so cynical. I'm thinking they also maybe want to get paid for that other surgery, right? Like, if he does the other surgery, he's going to get paid for it. Like, there's that cynical part of my brain that's like, we have for-profit healthcare, so why not go ahead? Why not go ahead and bill the insurance company for all the different things we can before this person's gone? That's cynical, I know, but I worry about it.
Okay. Well, this is a good topic. I'm glad you brought this up. So, I would say, I think there are some. There could be some like high up. Like, I don't think people think like doctors make a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. I mean, for the work they do. I mean, of course, they get paid well, but like the work they do,
right.
We don't need to worry about the doctors. People who are awful are admitted, like people who own the hospital.
Right.
Insurance companies. Right. Those are the people who are doing things for profit that could be like that. I don't think the general surgeon or the anesthesiologist, like people who they are truly there because they want to help people.
Right.
They're really not they're making money, but
they're not getting paid per surgery.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And if they are, it's like, it's not really like people who benefit from that stuff are people who like own the surgery center.
Right.
Like those are that's been my experience.
Yeah.
Right. So people always say like, oh, it's the doctors worrying. Because I've heard that before. It's like, no, man, they're not that high up. I know people think doctors are, for the most part, it's the people who like own it. The doctors above the doctors.
Right.
Well, you're a nurse, and obviously you're much more in contact with it. My brain tells me that these doctors have a problem at times having those conversations because they are trained like a soldier or anyone else to save this motherfucker's life.
Now,
that's
that
what I do. I save lives.
Now, that could be true.
Right?
That
like, I save lives. That's what I do, man. And, you know, there's got to be some sort of, you know, not like a football player or anything, some sort of determination to go to school for that long, to learn all about that stuff. And I am a fucking great doctor. And you guys, I can save them. I know I can save them. And I think, you know, letting that go sometimes is probably harder for them than it is for other people. And, ways, I really, really respect that, right? Like, no, I can do this. I know I can do this. I remember you want that confidence sometimes. My son, when he was little, was diagnosed with aortic stenosis. And we're in and we're talking to a pediatric cardiologist, and he can see, like you can, that I'm starting to get a little shaken up, right?
Yeah.
And he looks at me and he stops. He puts his hand on my leg real quick and he goes, "Hey, no matter what happens here, I can fix it." Aww. I'm telling you right now, we don't have to fix it. But if your son needs surgery, I will fix him. That's what I do. And all of a sudden, yeah, like, all my fears went away. Like, yeah, this motherfucker will fix him, right? Like, yeah. So as confident as he was and looked me in the eye and was basically like, "I got you.
Yeah,
I got you and I got him. You're in the right place."
And that's the right doctor. That's the right doctor, because I love doctors that say that.
But also, I think there's probably times in that man's career where he didn't have you.
Yeah.
But he's goddamn sure he was going to try, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's why I don't blame him.
That's what I mean. It's a fine balance, too. It's a fine balance. And there are, it's like, I'm not being like, don't do anything and just be okay with death.
Right.
Like that. But it's just like, maybe we could all get a little better at generally speaking about it, and like knowing your options. Specifically, if you work in a part of healthcare where certain diseases are pretty much terminal. There are certain diseases that you can get that you know you're likely going
to
die
from. Okay, we don't have to mention them by name, though. Yeah, but
we don't have to mention them by name. We don't have to do that, no. And is there a world where like we can discuss that openly? So this person can live better. It's truly for me, living better. And when you live better, you die better.
Yeah, it's so, like we talked about this, Laszlo, when they were running those commercials. I don't remember what I was watching, but I kept seeing the same commercial on the streaming service for some drug that says it's for cancer patients. I think it might have been specifically lung cancer, but you know, studies have shown that this drug could extend your life. I don't remember, it was like 2 months. And I just remember seeing this commercial over and over, like they're talking about extending your life 2 months. This is so depressing. This is so, and it just sounds like not a very impressive drug to me. But then you start thinking about it, if you're dying, those 2 months are valuable.
They could get you to a kid's graduation or a wedding, or there's a lot of things that can happen.
And I just didn't want
to
hear it.
Or even just time to, you know, sort it out, you know, with your family. Like, you know, because we all make so many mistakes throughout our lives that maybe, hey, man, this 2 months will give me time to try to reconnect with my brother or whatever I've done. I mean, that 2 months is a big deal, right?
Yeah.
And that's just one of those things that it's like, I just didn't want to hear about it. You know, I was like, hey, I'm trying to watch TV. Quit running this commercial for talking about people who are terminal. Nurse Julie, how do people follow you on social media? Because I guess most of them probably already are. You've got about a billion subscribers. But what, you're most active on TikTok?
No, I'm most active everywhere. I mean, to me, my YouTube is my favorite because I actually really get into the nitty gritty there, like where I really give a bunch of information. All the other places, like, it's hard to get. You know, you make 1 minute videos, right? So it's like how.
Well, I watch your YouTube, but I wondered if that's because of my age. I'm like, well, I'm watching on our YouTube, but you know, that's because I'm 41 years old.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of on all the socials, so TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube at Hospice Nurse Julie. So if you just put in Hospice Nurse Julie, the videos will pop up, and then if you're not into videos, my book's coming out June 11th, which hopefully will be, I want it to be a staple in people's homes.
Exactly. Yes, because dying at home is expensive, and you want to die at home, so you need to sell some of these damn books, and I will personally buy one. Right. I'll pre-order it now, Nothing to Fear, and it comes out, like you said, June 11th, so people buy the book.
And I just want to let you know that I have talked about death with my sons, and I have told them what I want, and that is to drive me to Nurse Julie's house as fast as possible, because she's just drop me off there. She won't. I don't think she has the balls to kick me out. So just lay me on her porch, and she'll make things all better. I'm so scared.
That's right. You guys did such a good job for being two hypochondriacs who do not want to talk about this. You did a great job.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And you did a great job of helping us to talk about it, which is your goal, and it's working, and it's something I never would have thought would be successful in a million years until I saw your videos. And then I went, oh, of course, we needed this. There was room for this, and no one was doing it. And she's going to just continue to get bigger and bigger. And I think your book's going to be huge as well. So I'm sure we'll start seeing you on The View and everywhere else soon.
Oh, thank you. You guys have been great. I will seriously you're like, no, we don't want you to come back. I'm like, let me come back.
No, come back.
You guys are so fun.
Yeah, come back, because I have more questions about, you know, options when it comes to dying and some, just a few things that I thought maybe it's a little too early in the morning to bring up, but I'd love to ask more questions sometime. So we'd love to have you back on the show.
Have a great day. We appreciate you.
Thank you. You too. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
And that is it. Thank you so much for listening. Toxic and Problematic is brought to you by Mitra 9 Kratom and Kava. Visit Mitra-9.com and use promo code PROBLEMATIC for 25% off your order. Thank you to Direct Computer Outlet in Mission, Kansas for making our Twitch stream possible. Music graciously provided by Kid Computer. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all The Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.